The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thanks to Andrew Locher for filling in on yesterday's broadcast, laboring away on Labor Day, the day that, typically the day Americans don't labor. So we appreciate him getting up early and broadcasting from our headquarters campus on the American holiday there yesterday morning. Couple of responses to his show. It says, thanks, Mr. Locher, for a wonderfully inspiring program in which you covered a smorgasbord of topics. Very special. Hearing about the high standards of excellence in our school and college. It says, and yes, if it had to be paid for in full value of its real worth, none of us could afford it. That comes from Canada. And then this one here from the Northeast United States, it says, I need these updates on the work. Each detail is like a priceless gem. Besides helping our prayers and service to God's work, and therefore helping God's work, the work itself is like air for a world that is drowning. Even on our best days, we can be pulled underwater, so to speak, by the world around us. And then further on, she says, even in the other daily programs, speaking of all the rest of us presenters, she says, this is always my favorite part, updates on the work, she means. In addition to being nourished by updates on the work, it seems I can see God using your presentations in a way that perhaps he is designing with me in mind. So some good feedback in response to Mr. Locher, Andrew Locher's radio program. Yesterday, lots to look forward to in the weeks ahead, as he brought out here in the UK, by the way. After the Feast of Tabernacles, we have the London Personal Appearance Campaign. That's scheduled for October 21st and 22nd. And the invitations for that campaign will be going out, I think, today and tomorrow. And hopefully we'll hit mailboxes all over the UK in the next few days, or certainly this week sometime. So we're anxious to see what kind of a response we get back from the invitations. And we've got now, five, 6 weeks before this particular campaign is upon us. So some exciting news for those of us in and around the Edstone area. Well, on today's program, if you caught Friday's program, we talked some about the month of September with respect to the late 1930s, the start of the Second World War in those first few days of October. And what is today? September. That's right. I've got all these months wrong. August. I said August for October, and we're in September, the start of World War II, early September, and then of course the Munich surrender. That was at the end of September the previous year, so back in 1938, 1939. We'll spend some more time on that in the second segment. We were able to take some of that material from Friday and then work it into a Bible study for a television recording on Sunday, so I'll bring that material to you in the next segment. Well, speaking of Friday's show, we talked also, just looking at some of the headlines, we talked about the German transformation, and here again, the stories keep piling high following these riots in Chemnitz. The aftermath, even up as recently as Saturday, I believe, there were something like 10 or 12,000 protesters out, and what was it? The Spiegel Online. It says, the return of the ugly German. So even the German press is having some things to say about the rise of the far right. And, of course, as we brought out on Friday, and as we wrote about at the end of 2015, it's not even these far right groups that are turning out. I saw some footage of someone embedded into one of the protests, and he was saying, look, most of these people here, they're just normal, ordinary Germans that are concerned about the immigration problem. They're concerned about the rise of crime coming as a result of these migrants. This article here from Politico, it brings out some stats to that end. It just says here, that question, can Germany survive Islam? That's the question. It says that question is once again at the center of the country's public discourse amid the violent protests that followed last week's brutal killing of a German man, allegedly at the hands of two Muslim refugees. And then it speaks of all the protests this past week, 11,000 or so on Saturday. It says there's nothing new about such clashes or even the debate over Islam. What the past week reveals, however, is the degree to which the refugee influx since 2015 continues to dominate the country's politics and fuel support for the far-right Alternative for Deutschland party. It says the pictures of marauding neo-Nazis in Chemnitz suggest the German government has largely failed to keep the violent extreme right in check, despite decades of trying. And again, if you go back to, I didn't bring it with me this time, but if you go back to that article that Richard Palmer and Brad McDonald wrote at the end of 2015, I mean, the forecast in that article, it's playing out. It's playing out on the ground right now in Germany. It says, by all rights, Germany should be celebrating a golden era. Unemployment is the lowest it's been since reunification amid robust economic growth. It says the country's public debt is on course to fall below 60% of gross domestic product this year. I mean, this just makes you wonder, what would it be like right now in Germany? What would it be like if it was also in the midst of a great economic crisis? Remember what Herbert Armstrong said. Remember what he said about what's going to trigger the formation of these 10 kings, this seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. I mean, right now, the German economy is booming. This should be a time for celebration. I mean, they should be celebrating a golden era. It says further on, describing Islam as an ideology of violence disguised as religion. This is actually about that book, Hostile Takeover. I mentioned that on Friday's show as well, the book written by this former Bundesbank official. Hostile Takeover. And I thought I'd just update you on that, that it debuted last week at number one on the German Amazon website. Amazon's bestseller in Germany. And then later on, finally, in this article, it says, last year, refugees were suspects in about 15% of homicides in Germany, according to official statistics, though they account for only 2% of the population. That's quite an astounding statistic. They account for about 2% of the population, and yet they're suspects, these refugees, in about 15% of the homicides. So there are some ordinary Germans that they've got a complaint, a legitimate complaint. These escalating crime statistics. Well, we'll keep our eyes on that as well. It seems like it's not going to die down. I want to draw your attention also to this story Brent Noctegal talked about on Trumpet Hour Friday about these Iranian missiles, how that Iran is now positioning these powerful missiles in Iraq. According to this Reuters report on Friday, as I said, Brent got into this with the panel on Trumpet Hour. A shocking report. Reuters says here, Iran moves missiles to Iraq in warning to enemies. That's the title. Iran has given ballistic missiles to Shiite proxies in Iraq and is developing the capacity to build more there and to deter attacks on its interests in the Middle East and to give it the means to hit regional foes, Iranian, Iraqi, Western, and Western sources say. So all of these sources are weighing in. From Iran, from Iraq, Western sources, Western officials as well, saying that, yeah, they're moving these missiles in there and there's nothing really that anyone can do about it. The Iraqi authorities can't do anything about it because they're under the control of these Iranian forces in Iraq. And again, who told you, who talked to you in the 1990s even about this Iranian takeover of its neighbor? And here they are now moving these missiles into Iraq, just one step closer, several steps probably, to Saudi Arabia, to Israel, Iran's enemies. It says Quds Force commander Qassem Soleimani is overseeing the program. Three of the sources said, it seems Iran has been turning Iraq into its forward missile base, the Western official said. Think about that. In light of these prophecies we've been keeping you mindful of over the last two decades, more than that even, they're turning Iraq into their forward missile base, this official says. The Iranian sources and one Iraqi intelligence source said a decision was made some 18 months ago to use militias to produce missiles in Iraq, but activity had ramped up in the last few months, including with the arrival of missile launchers. So it's just like the South China Sea for China. They're just building bases there. They've already got their army in there, the Quds Force. And now they're supplying them with missiles. Missiles that can easily reach into Israel and Saudi Arabia. And, of course, they're on the march toward a nuclear bomb as well. That's what they desperately want. Here again, go back and listen to that program from Friday where Brent discusses this development. That's on the Trumpet Hour. That's posted at our website, thetrumpet.com. Just one more quote. This is, I think, from an Iraqi official who is talking about how Iraq really is powerless to stop this. He says, we can't restrain militias from firing Iranian rockets because simply the firing button is not in our hands. It's with Iranians who control the push button. That's his way of saying they're in control. It's our country, so to speak, but they're the ones running things. They're the ones in control, certainly in control militarily. What does that say about who controls, who rules Iraq? And as I say, we were telling this decades ago. The Trumpet has been talking about this for years, as far back as 1992 and 1993. And over that time, you'll remember the focus from time to time, it was on, Saddam Hussein for a while. And then after he was taken out of the way, you had the emergence of ISIS. But now the dust is finally settling. ISIS has been crushed, and here is Iran controlling Iraq. That's pretty amazing. It's right there in Reuters from Friday. American Spectator had a really, really good piece today, just following up on this dangerous double standard that we keep talking about at the Justice Department in the United States. One standard for Democrats and then another one for Republicans. This article here talks about campaign financing violations. It's just from today. It's amazing, some of the detail here. In 2008, it says, Investors Business Daily reported that more than $190 million of Obama's campaign contributions were unidentifiable, and some of it was foreign and over the allowable limits. $190 million. I think the Obama people raised something like $400 to $450 million in that campaign back in 2008, setting all kinds of records. But $190 million of it, they were unidentifiable. The sources, some of them coming from overseas. Talk about collusion. It says here, Newsmax reported that this was the largest pool of unidentified money that has ever flooded into the U.S. election system. Before or after the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reforms in 2002, it says the Obama campaign simply refused to identify the contributors, probably because some of them were from the Middle East. And it goes on to talk about how a lot of this was chronicled at Atlas Shrugs, a website, a gold mine of information. This Spectator piece brings out, Andy McCarthy also wrote about it. So the RNC, the Republican National Committee, it registers a complaint with the FEC. This was several years after the fact, but in looking at what happened in 2008, nothing came of it. Nobody investigated it. Finally, the RNC complains about it and says, look, $190 million? And no one can identify where these contributions even came from? Is that legal? Well, the FEC ended up fining the Obama administration. I think it was $200,000 or $300,000. But President Obama was never held accountable. No one in his campaign, no one in his administration, he certainly wasn't impeached for it. It says here in 2011, there was no investigation, by the way. It was just the FEC fine, and that was it. And of course, the media was totally disinterested. They didn't care about it. I think this came to light in 2011. But it says here, in 2011, Obama again blatantly violated federal law when he used federal offices to raise campaign money. Specifically, he was illegally using the White House map room for partisan political fundraising and even sent out a video promoting such illegal activity. The RNC chairman at the time, Reince Priebus, sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder asking him to investigate, but Holder did nothing. Nor did any law enforcement agency or even the FEC investigate. Nobody did anything. Of course, all of that was under Obama's watch. He was president at the time. So it was Obama's DOJ. It was Obama's FBI. It was Obama's FEC. But then you compare all of that. I mean, $190 million unaccounted for? And here are the Justice Department, here are the investigations, here's the media. I mean, they're all going after President Trump. Over, I think, $150,000, $200,000, I forget the number. This article says again about that 2008 election, one of Obama's campaign associates approached Reverend Jeremiah Wright and offered him hush money. $150,000 to stay silent during the rest of the election. You know all about Reverend Wright, the racist, the radical, anti-white racist. And Barack Obama wanted him to shut up and tried to pay him off in a way that would influence the election, like we hear today. Well, how did this influence the election? How did these donations in 2008 influence the election? Unidentified contributors. And the Obama people just said, we're not going to tell you who they came from. It says here, fast forward to 2018, and an FEC complaint is filed by the Committee to Defend the President, claiming that Hillary's campaign, this is Hillary Clinton now, that her campaign committee, the Hillary Victory Fund, was using state chapters as straw men to circumvent campaign donation limits and launder the money back to her campaign. It says Dan Backer, the attorney who filed the complaint, explains in Investor's Business Daily that roughly $84 million may have been laundered in what might be the single largest campaign finance scandal in U.S. history. This just happened in the last election cycle. We're talking tens of millions of dollars. $84 million with Hillary, $190 million. And they're going after Donald Trump for paying these two women. $280,000, it says here in the article. Spectator says, we should also not forget the clear-cut federal campaign violations by Hillary's campaign when they paid a private group, Fusion GPS, to come up with this phony dossier. Remember how they paid for that? It was through the law firm called Perkins Coie. And then falsely described this expenditure on campaign disclosure forms as payment for legal services. They're getting legal services from Perkins Coie in the form of this dossier, this bogus dossier, which has been used to try to take down Donald Trump. It's astounding. Clearly, the article concludes, clearly, if you are Obama or Hillary, you can do just about anything to violate campaign finance laws. And the worst thing to happen is a slap on the wrist by the FEC. However, if you are a Republican like President Donald Trump, a very weak allegation of a campaign finance violation will not only be investigated by the feds, but is being used to bolster the Democrat argument that Trump should be impeached. This is why most Americans feel Lady Justice is no longer blind. There's a double standard. I mean, in the case of everything I just read to you, they couldn't even get an investigation going. You'll recall the Obama people bragging after he was out of office, saying that they had 8 years of a scandal-free presidency. Scandal-free. In fact, it was 8 years of an investigation-free presidency. None of these violations, none of this lawlessness, none of these scandals were looked at. They weren't even investigated. Quite a contrast to what we see happening today, to what we've seen over the last year and a half. As more and more of this is coming to light, this blatant double standard, this dangerous double standard of justice in the United States. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. America's status as the world's lone superpower is rapidly fading. Other nations and groups of nations are angling to fill the void. Rising in the East is an emerging power block of tremendous potential in manpower, economic heft, and military might. Its growing presence is intensifying global competition for resources and for geopolitical influence. Where will this trend lead? What does this mean for you? Biblical prophecy provides a remarkable, penetrating preview of Asia's future. Request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. This book exposes in startling detail what Russia and China are doing and will do, and how they will affect your life. Also, you'll be sent a free one-year subscription to The Trumpet magazine. The Trumpet looks at today's headlines through the clear light of Bible prophecy. The Trumpet will keep you up to date on the continuing rise of the powers in the East by taking a hard look at today's news and comparing it to the prophecies of the Bible. The Trumpet magazine is this world's most informed news magazine. To learn more, request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. Act today and request Russia and China in Prophecy. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
The city of Munich is one of the most historic cities in Europe. It's full of all kinds of culture. And for those who will remember, it's full of lessons. It was in Munich that one of the most important meetings in modern history took place. The Prime Minister of Britain was there. The Prime Minister of France was there. The Prime Minister of Italy was there. And so was the Chancellor of Germany. Of course, before this time, if you go back a couple of decades, all of these nations, the nations that these four represented, had gone through the most terrifying war in human history, World War I, the Great War. That was the war that, well, we saw warfare take a huge technological leap forward It was the war of the machine, machine guns, aircraft, tanks, artillery, shells, bullets, and the like. It was a worldwide horror story, and 20 million people died. And Europe and much of the world was shell-shocked after that cataclysm. And soon, though, there were more problems in the world, and nations were rising against nations. But there are enough people in these nations that were still, well, they had a working memory of what happened in the Great War, and they were terrified, so many of them, of another world war. Hitler wasn't, but many in the West were. So Neville Chamberlain and Edward Daladier, the French premier, they come to Munich along with Benito Mussolini, the Italian leader, and they sit down with Adolf Hitler. And they give to Adolf Hitler, the Western allies, Britain and France, they give Hitler everything that he asks for. He wanted a chunk of Czechoslovakia. And Czechoslovakia, of all things, had no say in the matter. They were standing on the sidelines. They weren't even invited to the meeting. They were thrown to the wolves by Britain and France in hopes of preserving peace. And that's what led to the infamous comments by Neville Chamberlain when he returned to London on September 30th, 1938. We played this for you on Friday, but here it is again. Chamberlain returning to London back in 1938 after making peace with Adolf Hitler, clip one.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
You hear the cheering there at the end. And again, coming after the horrific shock of the Great War, you can understand why they were cheering so hard. They didn't want another war. They wanted to rest. They wanted to be with their families. They didn't want to confront this great evil. And so they were thrilled with what Chamberlain was doing. Chamberlain came back as popular as ever and remained so for even a number of months after that. But then Britain began to wake up. As Churchill said, we'll know in a year if that piece of paper will hold, or words to that effect. And of course, we knew. Less than a year, 11 months, Hitler invaded Poland and World War II began. And at the end of that war, another 50 to 60 million people were killed. 2 Timothy 4. Let's just look at some of these verses that talk about our time today. I mean, we look at some of that old footage or hear that soundbite that you just heard, and we think, well, how could he have done that? And if we were put in that position today, hindsight being 20/20, as they say, we think, well, there's no way I would even sit down with Hitler, let alone make a deal with him. Well, we would never make that kind of a catastrophic mistake today. Really? Is that true? Well, you look at the history, and then you look at these prophecies. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1, of course, says that this is for the last days. Dangerous times are coming upon us, Paul said. And then in chapter 4, verse 3, it says, "For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers, having itching ears." The time's coming when they just won't endure sound speech. They won't listen to the truth. They have itching ears, meaning they want to hear things that pleasantly tickle the ears. They don't want words of war. They want to hear pleasant things, smooth things, as Isaiah said. Verse 4, it says here, "And they shall turn away their ears from the truth, and shall be turned unto fables." On Friday's program, I mentioned that speech that Churchill gave in October 5th, 1938, following the Munich surrender. This was just 5 days or so later, where Churchill basically said, "Look, I don't grudge our loyal, brave people. Look at what they've been through. Look at what happened 20 years earlier. I don't grudge their natural, spontaneous outburst of joy upon seeing Chamberlain come back with that piece of paper. But they should know the truth. Someone should have told them the truth. Chamberlain should have been telling them the truth. Parliament should have been telling them the truth. Fleet Street should have been telling them the truth. But truth failed in 1938. And before that, the people of Britain weren't getting the truth. And did you know that God says it's going to be even worse today, even worse in these last days? I mean, you see the kind of media blackout in the 1930s. Well, they just wouldn't say what was happening in Austria or Czechoslovakia or the Rhineland. Even after Germany started the World War, I mean, it was all that you could do just to get the truth about what was actually happening in Poland. It took a while for the British people to wake up. And what does God say for our time? What does he prophesy for our time today? Isaiah 56, notice this, verse 10. Here's the prophet basically comparing our leaders today to lazy, slothful watchdogs. His watchmen are blind, it says. They're all ignorant. They're all dumb dogs. They can't bark, sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber. I mean, what a picture. Here, like my father covers in the Isaiah booklet, you've got these ferocious Gentile beasts surrounding us. They're ready to devour. They're ready to strike. And yet our leaders, the leaders of society, the elites, the educated elite, the watchmen, they're like dumb dogs who won't bark. They just won't bark. They won't warn. Verse 11 says, this is the Revised Standard Version, "The shepherds also have no understanding. They have all turned to their own way, each to his own gain, and one and all," it says. "Come," they say, "let us get wine. Let us fill ourselves with strong drink. And tomorrow will be like this day, great beyond measure." See, the leaders, the media elites, they're just concerned about their own selfish interest. They're more concerned about their own selfish interest than they are about peace and safety, than they are about the real looming threats. These ferocious beasts that are surrounding our nations. God says the worst time of suffering this planet has ever seen, it's about to explode over all the earth. Jeremiah 30 and verse 7. Daniel 12:1, Matthew 24:21. The Apostle Peter said that we better be sober and vigilant. Our adversary is going about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. This is real, these dangerous, dangerous days that we're in. Back in Isaiah 30, it says in verse 8, My father's referred to this verse probably hundreds of times over the years. Isaiah 30 and verse 8, how it says there that Isaiah, he needed to go and write this down, this prophecy, in a book, that it may be for the time to come forever and ever. See, it's for the last days. God wanted it written and preserved. And notice what it says in the next two verses. This is Isaiah 30, verses 9 and 10, that this is a rebellious people. Write this down, Isaiah. This is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Eternal, which say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. I mean, don't give us the truth. Give us what we want to hear. Give us the smooth things. So as it turns out here for the last days, I mean, it's not all, we can't pin all the blame on the back of the elites. Here are the people saying they want smooth things. And of course, the media and the politicians, like we just read, they're more than happy to give them things that make people cheer. Churchill said, I think I read this Friday too, he said back in 1932 that I can't recall at any time when the gap between the kind of words which statesmen used and what was actually happening in many countries was so great as it is now. I mean, they just weren't reporting the truth. They weren't telling the truth. And then he said this, an obvious reference to this passage in Isaiah, the habit of saying smooth things and uttering pious platitudes and sentiments to gain applause without relation to the underlying facts is more pronounced now than it ever has been in my experience. I mean, he was going through the 1930s thinking, I've never seen anything like this. Well, look at today. Look at what, as I've said so many times before, look at what dominates the news cycles today in the United States and Britain. My father wrote in the Winston Churchill booklet, he said that that's the biggest challenge each one of us must always face. Do we really want to hear the truth? So you go back to that statement Churchill made in October of 1938. You can't begrudge the people for rejoicing at the thought of peace, but they should know the truth. They should have gotten the truth. And that's the biggest challenge we face. Do we really want to hear the truth? I mean, you can get to it. Satan, of course, tries to drown it out with all the noise. But you can get to the truth. If you go to the trumpet, or if you watch the Key of David, or if you listen to KPCG, my father back in 2009, he gave a Key of David program where he talked about what Churchill contended with in the lead up to World War II back in the late 1930s. Here's what my father had to say, clip two.
Leading up to World War II, even in 1939, the very year that the war began on September the 1st that year, and the media and the government in Britain were talking about a golden age was about to dawn on the world. And it was just about it was the worst nightmare they'd ever experienced that was about to come upon them. So actually the media and the government and the people that were supposed to be warning them and telling them about what was coming were all wrong. They were all wrong about what was going to happen. Well, what about...
That's my father from 2009. They all got it wrong in the lead up to World War II. Everyone except for Churchill. He got up in that October speech from 1938 and said, look, I'll start by saying what everybody would like to ignore or forget. But that nevertheless needs to be stated, namely, that we have sustained a total and unmitigated defeat. I'll say what no one else wants to say. I'll say what everyone else would like to ignore. We have sustained a total and unmitigated defeat, and our loyal, brave people should know the truth. They should know the truth about what's happened. and he gave it to them. They should know that there has been gross neglect and deficiency in our defenses. They should know that we have sustained a defeat without a war, the consequences of which will travel far, far with us along our road. They should know that we have passed an awful milestone in our history when the whole equilibrium of Europe has been deranged and that the terrible words have for the time been pronounced against the Western democracies. You are weighed in the balance and found wanting. That's paraphrasing Daniel 5 and verse 27. You are weighed in the balances and found wanting. There's no substance. There's no weight there. It's just fluff. Ezekiel 33, the Watchman chapter, it has something to say about that period leading up to World War II, and also quite a lot to say about our day as well. Verse 1, it says, this is Ezekiel 33, again, the word of the Eternal came unto me, saying, Son of man, speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, when I bring the sword upon the land, if the people of the land take a man of their coast and set him for their watchman, if when he sees the sword come upon the land, he blows the trumpet and warns the people. God did bring that sword upon our nations. And someone named Winston Churchill came on the scene at the last possible moment. The people set him up as their watchman. And he saw the sword. He saw the sword before he was in position to do anything about it. He saw it rising in Europe. He warned of the rising tensions between European nations. Well, you can read the next several verses, verses 4 to 6. God talking about that World War II era. And then in verse 7, the time period shifts to our last days. Verse 7 says, So you, O son of man, I've set you a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore you shall hear the word at my mouth and warn them from me. So this is no longer talking about the World War II era. There's a dramatic shift here. It brings us right to the present time. God selecting his watchman. God says, you send them warning from me. You tell them this message comes from God. Well, that's the work that you listeners are enthusiastically supporting, this watchman work. What a weighty responsibility. Verse 8 says, When I say to the wicked, O wicked man, you shall surely die. If you do not speak to warn the wicked from his way, that wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at your hand. Nevertheless, if you warn the wicked of his way to turn from it, if he do not turn from his way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul. Over and again, God says, you warn them. You tell them what's coming. And then they can do something about it. And if they don't, then it's their trouble. It's their fault. It's their problem. Verse 10 says, Therefore, O you son of man, speak to the house of Israel. Thus you speak, saying, If our transgressions and our sins be upon us, and we pine away in them, how should we then live? Say to them, As I live, says the eternal God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn you, God says, turn you from your evil ways. For why will you die, O house of Israel? God's talking about dying nations. And this has happened historically, and it's happening today. We can't sit back and think, oh, well, we're so sophisticated, we're so technologically advanced, this could never happen. That's what they thought in the lead up to World War I. I mean, the advancements there, the machine age. And then World War II, taking it to another level. And the carnage, the unimaginable carnage, millions upon millions, tens of millions. And yet all the elites of that time thinking, well, there's no way we're going to do this again. Not after World War I, not after the Great War. We won't make the same mistake again. I mean, that was the war to end all wars. Well, how long did it last? That piece of paper that Chamberlain returned with from Germany, from Munich, it was just a little type of the blip on that 6,000-year history of man that was between 1918 and 1938 and 39, just 20 years. Well, we've had a little bit of a longer period of relative stability around the world, thanks in no small part to the American superpower, which has held the peace following World War II. The world's policeman. And now we see that world order. It's turned on its head. And all these emerging powers. And God says to his watchmen, you get out there and talk about the death of nations. You talk about a war, a world war that starts with nuclear weapons, not ends with an atomic weapon. Down in verse 28, it says, for I will lay the land most desolate, and the pomp of her strength shall cease, and the mountains of the Eternal shall be desolate, that none shall pass through. Then shall they know that I am the Eternal, when I have laid the land most desolate because of all their abominations, which they have committed. This is a prophecy for the very end. It's right before Israel collapses, right before our nations fall apart. And to our great shame, we won't come to God. We won't turn to God until we go through this kind of suffering. I was reading an old article by my father yesterday, Shakespeare and the British Empire, I think it was, and he was talking about Shakespeare's time period back in the 1500s, thereabouts, saying how that it was just customary back then, if you were a poet or an author or a politician or whoever, it was just customary to actually study the Bible. And my father said, just after making that point, how condemning that is to us today, because who even looks into the Bible? Who cares about what the Bible says? Who studies Ezekiel 33 or Isaiah 30 or Isaiah 56? This is how God has to get our attention, sadly, because we're not paying attention now. And so as our nations collapse, then, and only then, will people begin to sit up and take note. Verse 30, and the Moffat says, as for you, O son of man, your people are talking about you in the streets and at the doors of their houses, saying to one another, come and let us hear what is the word from the Eternal today. They love to come and listen to the message. They love to hear the watchman's message. These are people that are familiar with it, mostly Laodiceans. Maybe some co-workers and donors that never really did act on this. But they have respect for God's prophet. They want to hear about the work. They want to hear the message from God. They acknowledge that it is God's message. But there's still a breakdown. Verse 31 says, and they come unto you as the people come, and they sit before you as my people, and they hear your words, but they will not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goes after their covetousness. This is a message that's mainly for God's people. Many of God's people, those who've turned away from God in this last hour, those who've fallen away from the truth since the death of Herbert Armstrong, they know about the strong prophetic warning coming out from this church, but they won't apply it. They won't use it. They're eager to hear. They're happy to listen. It's like a lovely song. Verse 32 says that, and lo, you are unto them as a very lovely song, and one that has a pleasant voice and can play well on an instrument, for they hear your words, but they do them not. See, they're eager to listen. but they won't do the words. It's hard to get people who are really eagerly working to apply the truth of God, the laws of God, when times are so good. But when the nations start to collapse, that's when they begin to change their tune. That's when they begin to cry out to God. And this explains why God, has to bring this level of destruction, this level of correction. But look, this time, I mean, you go back to that history, World War II, and God intervened. That was the sixth resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire coming out of the heart of Europe, not the seventh and final one. And so Winston Churchill, the people selected a watchman. They raised him up. And Churchill just barely rescued them. He led them through their darkest hour. A dreadful year, 1940. Then the U.S. was bombed into the war in late 1941. And then finally the tables began to turn as things swung more in the favor of the Allies. But they very, very nearly lost everything. But it wasn't yet time. And so God intervened. And what about this time? Verse 33, it says, "And when all of this comes to pass, and lo, it will come, then shall they know that a prophet has been among them." You see, when all the prophecies are fulfilled, when they come to pass, then they will know. But like my father brings out in the Ezekiel booklet, by that point it'll be too late physically. It'll be too late physically. And yet God in his mercy will rescue them, many of them, spiritually anyway, during the Great Tribulation. What a message. What a warning. How important is this message today? It's so important that when the next Holocaust happens, there's going to be people all over this earth who immediately know that the prophetic message they heard coming from the Philadelphia Church of God, coming from God's work in these last days, they'll know that it was God's message. They'll know that God's watchman was, in fact, there sounding the alarm. And then many will begin to do something about it, even at that point. Of course, all of this ushers in the return of Jesus Christ to this earth, the only sure hope there is for this world. Well, I'm going to break it off there just a few minutes early so I can get downstairs for my next lecture. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you again tomorrow.